I'm going to stand down here, as I like to wave my arms a lot and point. Can everybody hear me okay? Is this working? We were told strictly to make sure this is not a sales presentation, so I'm going to do my best to keep it somewhat academic here, okay? If I stray, I apologize in advance. And about 2 or 3 months ago, I was on an airplane, and I was reading one of these Delta or United or American magazines, and they had the top 10 things you don't do when you're public speaking. And one of them was, don't talk about your family. Because people, your audience, they really don't care about your family. So I think I'm going to start off on the wrong foot here. I've got this adorable little four-year-old girl. Her name's Ella. And she's got a maniac twin brother named Owen. And then an older brother named Zach, who's 6. And she's truly the rose among the thorns. And somehow, not because she's been spoiled at all, but she thinks she's a little princess, okay? And not that we condone television, but she's got this show that she just goes nuts over. It's called Sophia the First. It's about a little girl who's a princess. Now that's not the interesting part. The interesting part is she can take this Comcast remote, go downstairs and turn that TV on, and then turn the DVR on in the cable box. And then she can get to the DVR listings of all the recordings. She can scroll down, and through sort of character recognition, she can find Sophia the First. She can figure out which one's been viewed, which one hasn't, watch a new one, and play it. And then what she can also do is fast forward through the commercials. Okay, she can't tie her shoes, she can't do a lot of stuff, but she can work that Comcast remote because it's the same every single day. Nothing changes. It's the same buttons, it's the same process. Every day when we wake up, we probably have the same sort of processes. You wake up, maybe you go downstairs and you put on a pot of coffee. Maybe you go to Starbucks. Go to Starbucks, you get your coffee, you get in your car, you drive the same route, you put on the same radio station, you start to learn the radio personalities, you become comfortable with it. Okay, it's those routines that we like. Human beings like routines. We're creatures of habit. When all of a sudden we're driving and there's a big traffic jam and my commute normally takes 15 minutes, now it's going to take 45 minutes, we start sweating. What do? Get on my phone. Look if there's an alternate route. We don't like the change. We don't like the flexibility. What happens if Starbucks decided that they were going to close and open when they wanted? There would be mass hysteria. You go there to get your coffee at 8:45 and they're closed. It won't work. We like the routines. So at Strata, we're fully convinced in order to make proximity detection so that it works across the board, it has to be a routine. It has to be stable. It has to be something that when I go in on a Monday and I leave on a Friday, nothing's changed in that week. If we look at our brain up there, the smallest part of our brain, according to this pizza pie here, is flexibility. We don't like things to be flexible. We like things to be predictable. We like to know how things are going to happen. When things become unpredictable, that's when we stop, that's when we pause, and we have to start to process. And we need to make proximity so that it's second nature. So there's no stopping, there's no pausing, there's no processing. So how do we make proximity routine? Part of our human nature. It needs to be repeatable, simple, and most importantly, it needs to be predictable. You need to go underground and be able to anticipate how this thing is going to work and have it worked how you anticipate it. So ultimately, what we battle with as a supplier is we can supply gobs of technology. But underground, it's the human factor that's really going to constrain the technology. It happens in all types of industries. People can come up with all great products, but the ones that actually work are the simple ones, the ones that have a single button, right? Look at this, one button. They used to have gobs and gobs of buttons. Now there's one. So we talk to a lot of users, a lot of customers, And, you know, when you ask them, what are you looking from a proximity detection system? You hear a whole bunch of things. But what it really boils down to, much like Mike McMillian just said, a fail-safe system to aid in the enforcement of red zones. Okay? Perfect segue into this. That's what they want. Whatever they consider the red zones, whether it's the Virginia red zones or the red zones that they deem appropriate in their minds, it's an enforcement of those red zones. And on top of that, you want to be able to train your miners. You want to train them so that even if you were to pull this system away for a period of time, they now have habits and routines that keep them away from those red zones. If you can accomplish those two first ones, and the third one, that's fantastic, because these coal companies are not charitable organizations. They need to make money. They don't want loss of production. So what we try to do is provide those first two without a decrease in production. So here's where Strata has misstepped a couple times, and I think the industry could misstep in general. What does the user want? We've got this nice green apple. I want to cut that apple and eat it. Well, what do you need to cut an apple? You need a single blade. Pick the tool that's right for cutting the apple. What we're looking at and verging on right now is offering a Swiss Army knife. Okay, I got that Swiss Army knife. Which blade am I going to use? Oh, look, I got tweezers. I can pull the apple seeds out with these tweezers. That's kind of cool. That's not what we need to do. We need a clean, concise product that's going to cut that apple. So what credibility do I have up here talking about proximity detection? I was never a coal miner. I haven't spent much time underground. Okay? But I bring products to market. That's what I've done my life. Anybody can produce a product. But to produce a product that people want to buy and use is a difficult thing. And you really need to put yourself in their shoes to understand that. Ask questions. Respond to their feedback. So what credibility do we have? We've been at this for almost 10 years on the research and development side. We've had systems underground in coal mines, hard rock mines, and surface mines for almost 6 years now. We have customers that are around the world. Our largest install base is in South Africa. We have an install base here in the US, Canada, Chile, Australia, large installation going on in Papua New Guinea. Not a place you need to go, by the way. And there's over 1,000 of those systems and growing around the world. You know, when you install these surface systems, it's 250 out of whack, okay? So they're large installations. You start to get a lot of feedback from your customers, a lot of lessons learned that you can start to incorporate into your product. On the right-hand side are all the types of pieces of equipment that we have proximity detection running on. We had it on long walls. It's no longer on a long wall. But we'll come in and save Consol when they need one at some point. But we have a vast experience in the field and a lot of lessons learned. So what have we offered over the time? And what I'm going to talk about is how you can have multiple pieces of equipment in a mine-wide environment, but make it simple, okay? And where we started was in 07 in South Africa. South Africa was really the first country that started to adopt proximity detection in a big way, and the first company in South Africa was Sasol Mining. We have about 300 pieces of equipment alone at Sasol right now. South Africa, the entries are wider. The seam heights are taller. The equipment and the miners on foot are not in such close proximity. So we had what we called static zones. And I'm going to go into more detail of all these zone configurations in the following slides. But I'll tell you an interesting thing. Of all the pieces of equipment we have in South Africa, there's been tremendous blood, sweat, and tears that have gone into those systems. Plenty of complaints, okay? We've gone through, we've taken care of them. The things that they've never complained about are the zone sizes. And you got to understand, I mean, they're very simple zones. In South Africa, you've got the whole continent of Africa, different languages underground. I think there's something like 18 different languages spoken underground in South Africa. Okay, so training is unbelievably difficult. They've got a common mining language that consists of like 25 or 30 words. Okay, but it's a really difficult environment to train. So I think those simple static fields actually were a benefit there. Now let's fast forward to 2010. MSHA starts talking about an emergency temporary standard for continuous miners. Okay, mines start to get interested. What does this mean? Let's start to test this out. Entries are narrower. Seam heights are shallower. The equipment and personnel are much tighter. And we have to start looking at shaping these fields and doing certain things to them so that the machines can interact with one another without affecting production. And that's when we started to come up with what we call configurable zones. The other thing that was interesting is the mine operators had a greater interest in the technology. Okay, so we'd sit down with a mine operator and say, hey, this is great, but can you start to do this? Or have you looked at that? Sure, we can do that. We'll look at that. And we start to do that. And we start to come up with these, what we call configurable zones. Then we go a little bit further. And we have what's called dynamic zones. Okay? Because the mine operators are saying, hey, it would really be great if you could do X or Y or Z. And I'll talk more about what we do with those those dynamic zones. But there were a couple reasons that we kept going down this path. First of all, we didn't know what MSHA was going to put in their rule. We saw what's going to be in the proposed rule, but we had to make our system flexible because we're already selling systems to the mines. So we had to make sure when a mine bought a system that in the end, when that rule came out, we may have to go make some software changes, but we can marry up to what that rule looks like. So we'll go back to 2007. It was a very simple system. If you wanted a continuous miner, that's what your field looked like. It looked like that with a certain distance. A continuous miner was a continuous miner was a continuous miner. The fields didn't change. Shuttle car, same thing. It might get a little bigger if the piece of machinery was bigger, but the distances were the same. There wasn't a whole lot of thought that went into doing this. But after looking at this over 5 or 6 years and the lessons learned, and with South Africa coming back and never complaining about fields and training as a snap, it's because those fields never change. At Sasol, they've got, what, Dwayne, 50 sections? 52 operating sections. They move miners from section to section. Can you imagine with 18 different languages being spoken underground, if I went from one section and zones were configured one way, and I went to another section and they were configured another way, it would be mayhem. But that's not an issue because it's the same every place where they go. So in the US, we took those static zones, and then what we said is, let's make them configurable, meaning that it's not going to be a standard 3 meters for a warning zone and 1 meter for a stop zone. Let's listen to what the mine operators want, and we can tune this thing and shape it to what they want. And so that's what we did. We could really go in there, and we would sit down with a mine operator and say, okay, here's a continuous miner. What do you want these fields to look like? And we could tune it to do that. The fatal mistake we made was we could go to a mining company that had 3 mines. And we would go to mine A, and that operator would want something different than mine B, who would want something different than mine C. And all of a sudden, now you have this mishmash of zones. It doesn't, I mean, it works fine for that mine, but in the long run, to get a simple system, it's really not the right approach. Probably the biggest thing that we did at the time was we realized, it wasn't like it was an aha moment, but you've got pieces of machinery that articulate. You've got a continuous miner with a conveyor boom that moves back and forth. You have a battery hauler that articulates in the middle. Well, common sense would tell you the zone should follow a piece of equipment. Okay? If I've got a battery hauler, I got to make sure that when that piece of equipment starts to articulate and I'm 3 feet off, that it stays 3 feet off. Okay? For example, if I've got a boom, conveyor boom, and I'm not articulating with that conveyor boom, my field needs to be rather large. Looks like the back of a goldfish tail. Because I need to cover that entire distance of the slewing of that conveyor boom. Now, with the fields tracking the conveyor boom, it leaves areas for the miners to stand. And so that was a big improvement. And then we moved to dynamic. Mine operators and us were saying, okay, you know, there's certain inputs. We can take these inputs, and then we can change the fields dynamically while the machines are doing something. So let's look at what those inputs are. The speed of the piece of equipment, right? I'm moving fast, I'm a shuttle car, I need a big zone out in front of me. I come back, now I'm moving slow. The zone doesn't need to be as big because the stopping distance isn't as long. What else did we do? Input based from the machine. An example there, it was even in the proposed rule. When the cutter head is in rock or coal, the zones around the continuous miner can change. They can decrease because when the cutter head's in rock or coal, apparently the continuous miner can't tramp. What else do we do? Input from the person. We had one mine that said, what we want to do is we're concerned about the zones changing automatically. We want human input. Sounds good. Let's do that. So what we did there, you've got a miner operator who's standing here. He's operating the continuous miner. Shuttle car comes up. As he gets in the warning zone of that shuttle car, and if that shuttle car is below a certain speed, he presses a button and shrinks the zone. Comes together. Works great. Okay? All this stuff works. There's no doubt about it. But what we're doing is we're still continuing to build this Swiss Army knife, which is not a bad thing. It's good to have options. But we're coming back to full circle. Okay? We've got years of experience with all these different types of systems. We've got plenty of experience dealing with folks like Mike McMillian and his folks at Consol, Peabody, BHP, Xstrata, Exaro, Sasol, Optimum, Barrick Gold. Big list of customers that are giving us this feedback. And what we're coming back to is this idea of static zones, but highly refined static zones. Okay? So what do we consider when we're making these highly refined static zones? And I've got some graphics here to show you in a minute. Let's look at the first two lines. Not all the machines operate in the same fashion, and miners on foot interact with the machines differently. Let's look at those two lines and the pieces of equipment. You have a continuous miner, okay? Slow moving, production piece of equipment, articulates, remote operator. Generally, you have a cable handler, okay? You look at a shuttle car, operators on it, moves pretty quick. Haulage piece of equipment, generally there's not too many people working around it. It's got a cable, so it always goes the same way. Then we move to a battery hauler. Similar to a shuttle car, except it articulates. Doesn't have a cable, so we can go wherever it wants. So there is a difference there, so we need to look at those different fields. And then let's take a look at a scoop, okay? Operator on board, but you're going to have people working around the front of that machine. So you need to look at each machine in a different way, how it operates, how people interact with it, and then come up with your zones. Training. Training's huge. South Africa, we're going back to South Africa, 18 different languages underground, static zones. You can have a miner who's been underground for a month, and a new miner will come down, and he can teach that miner about proximity detection system. Because it's the same every single day. It's routine. It's just like my little daughter. If she wanted to teach her crazy brother Owen, if he was interested in TV or Sophia the First at all, she could take that remote control. In about 5 minutes, she could teach him how to do it. I don't have to call Comcast to have a guy show up in a van to do a presentation on how to use the Comcast controller. It's the same every day. It's very easy to train. This one right here, zone inspections, people don't understand what the impact of this could have. Okay? I believe there's going to be inspections on some frequent basis of zones, right? If I've got a static zone, I come up, I do my measurements, I think every week, check in the book, we're good to go. What do I do when that zone, when that piece of equipment is moving fast? Do I run along the side of it and put a stick out there to try to measure it? And then if it's, there's probably going to be, if you're set up to reduce a zone at a certain speed, MSHA is probably going to want to make sure that you're reducing it at a certain speed. So now you're going to have to test the correlation of the speed to the zone. And you got to do this on every week, on lots of equipment. And then last but not least, I can show you pictures and diagrams that have great colors and pictures. But when I go underground and you go underground and you're working around the machine, you don't see those colors. There's no zones. You don't see yellow, reds, and blues. Okay? So you need, as Mike made the example, and I've used that example in the past about a dog fence, but it didn't go over well, the comparison of dogs to miners, so I don't use that anymore. But it's a great example. That dog, when that car goes by and that dog starts to run to bark at that car, it knows exactly where to stop every single time. That's what we need to do for proximity detection. So as an example, what are we doing with these highly refined zones? MSHA or NIOSH put together this fatalgram, right, for continuous miners. And you look at this and you say, okay, let's just illuminate or highlight the areas where there's been issues. Okay, we go ahead and do that. Well, lo and behold, what ends up happening is where there haven't been any issues, there's safe places to stand. You can stand where it's yellow. Okay? And I don't want to make it so that it's only safe to stand there at certain times. If it's always safe to stand there, it's always safe to stand there. And so this is an example of what we're looking at of highly refined zones. Now I've got a video here. Hopefully it should work. First, what I'm going to show, this is our configurable and dynamic zone. You can see the zones follow the conveyor, swings back and forth. In comes a continuous miner or a shuttle car. Through whichever input, the zones are going to start to shrink. Okay? Pretty cool stuff. It works. Miner operator now has a place to stand between the shuttle car and the continuous miner, and he can mine coal. He can operate. Now we're going to see the same process, but without the zones. There's our continuous miner. There are zones slewing back and forth. We think they're big. In comes a shuttle car. Is a shuttle car moving slow enough in order to have the slow zones? You just don't know. You can't see it. You can put flashing lights on it to tell you what's going on. But once again, those flashing lights, the human being has to stop and say, what does that flashing light mean? And as soon as you get too many flashing lights, it becomes difficult to process. It's kind of like our pod. Keep it simple. This is what we affectionately call the poodle balls. It looks like a dog with little, that's a little poodle ball on the end of its tail. It articulates with it. Now we're going to have a shuttle car come in. The zones are not going to change. Everything's staying the same. Lo and behold, you end up actually having more places to stand without tripping the proximity detection system. Okay, so this is where we're looking to go. The key is refined, simple zones that are repeatable, predictable, that don't affect production. Whoa. That's a safety hazard there, Dave. What? Almost done? Perfect, because I'm almost done. Okay. Somebody asked the question, does this stuff work? You know, Mike, have you seen a reduction in fatalities or injuries? We don't know. What we did a study with BHP. They put proximity detection. How much time do I have, Dave? How much time? 5 minutes, perfect. BHP in South Africa took a section of equipment, put proximity detection on everything. And as Mike said, all the information is recorded. Okay, so we've got this thing called Hazard Link, where anytime somebody walks into any of the zones, it's recorded and it's wirelessly transmitted to the surface. So what BHP did is they put proximity detection on the machines, put pads on the people, but didn't have alarms, sounders, or stop the machine, and took a look at how many times did people actually go into the red zones. And that's this. That's how many times in a month on a CM they went into the red zone. Shuttle car, roof bolter, feeder breaker. Then what they did the second month is they put proximity on, they fired it up, stopped the machine, had alarms. Huge reduction. There's a third month. Now, anecdotally, sure, we asked them, did it affect production? In the first week and a half, yeah, they had a dip in production, okay? But now it's back up and it's stable. And so what this shows is, over time, and not much time, we can train the people in the mine to stand in safer locations, without affecting production. And that's the key. Those are the assumptions that we have in the beginning of what the miner operators are looking for. And proximity detection is a very complex system, but it doesn't need to be if you can simplify it down to the key factors. And so, in conclusion, we believe that a simplified, static, repeatable, predictable proximity detection system will enforce hazard zones, will perform on multiple pieces of machinery in a mine-wide environment, will definitely aid in training, will not affect production, and will simplify inspections and field testing. That's it.
Any questions for Mike? Can you come over to the microphone, please, if you don't mind? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, what's the limitations on the number of tags that can be picked up on the system successfully?
There is no limitation.
So if you have a shuttle car full of people, there'll be no issue?
None whatsoever. Okay. Our system, it doesn't work on a handshake, or we're not doing, you can run into some situations where you have an N-1 problem, where you have a number of receivers and you can only deal with the number of receivers minus one. So if you have five receivers, you can only track four people. We have a different type of architecture, so there's no limit on the number of pads or tags that could be around the piece of equipment.
Would it start affecting performance at all, though, the more tags you have in the system?
No, there's no latency degradation at all. And if you want, after, I can explain, bring you over there and explain why. Because there's no handshaking process, you don't have latency in processing that would create slowing up of the machine or the response time.
Okay.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. That was an excellent presentation.